Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
Wendy Williams was talking about it. Howard Stern talked about it. The View talked about it.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotaro. This week, we talk to Rakia Mays. Rakia is a journalist, radio personality, author, and activist. She has been a major voice in hip-hop on the airwaves, on the page, and behind the scenes, and she has now turned her attention to fiction. Her debut novel, The Man Curse, was just published by Simon & Schuster Digital. Rakia began her career at Vibe, working closely with then-editor-in-chief Danielle Smith during the magazine's golden age. She then became a freelance journalist before moving on to radio, where she worked for both of New York City's giant hip-hop stations, Power 105 and Hot 97. The Man Curse, released this past November, chronicles the struggles of a young woman who works at a suspiciously familiar-seeming urban magazine under a glamorous editor-in-chief, as she attempts to become the first woman in her family to find true love. We connected with Rakia via Skype. If you enjoy The Cipher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should check out our interview with another powerful music industry player, Timbisa Mshaka, on episode 122. You can find more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play, at thecyphershow.com. While you're there, make sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter to keep track of everything that's going on with us. And now, here's the breaker of the man curse, Rakia Mays. The first thing I was really able to find out about you was, you know, college radio, basically. And I was just curious about before that. Where'd you grow up? How'd you first get into hip hop, into writing, that kind of stuff? Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, your life pre getting into media?
Yeah. I was born in Newark, New Jersey. And that's where most of my family are from, even before that, South Carolina, Newark, New Jersey. And my mother moved us, at the time, myself and my brother, out of Newark. You know, she didn't like the school system in Newark. She wanted us to have a better education. And so we moved to the suburbs in Jersey, Somerville, New Jersey, was there, and then eventually Piscataway, New Jersey, which is where I graduated high school. And a lot of my family, you know, tend to be still. And so, yeah, that's what it was. Jersey girl.
Nice. And where did hip hop first come into the picture for you?
Hip hop was my escape. I remember, you know, as a teenager, you know, in the early 90s, and, you know, teenagers have the back and forth and issues with their parents, and, you know, you're going through puberty or whatever you're going through, and you just want to be alone. And I remember that at the time I was listening to the radio, and I was a big Wendy Williams fan because she was a Jersey girl, and she was, you know, I would call. I was the one that would call and win tickets. I won multiple tickets. I think I won tickets for it was like Naughty by Nature. I'm aging myself. Naughty by Nature and Queen Latifah at Essex County College in Newark. And that's sort of where it began. And then it was something about hip hop. I don't know, but I know I would stay up really late, you know, trying to catch Static or Stretch and Bobbito.
WKCR, it is 1:02 in the morning. And this is the Stretch Armstrong Show. Bobbito's by my side. We're back. What's up?
Right there, dude. Shorty with that fucked up ass hairdo. Now who do you think the fuck you was fooling? Looking like voodoo on a stick and smelling like you never be douching. But fuck
W.
to Special K and Teddy Ted, The Awesome Two.
Hot Sounds at All Two Clubs dropping Mad Flavor on 105.9, of course, setting the trends that others may check out. But hey, give us a call on the Vibe Line, 212-219.
You know, I would have my cassette tape and I would tape. And then as I got into college, you know, that was, you know, my first freshman year. I was at like Penn State, way in the boonies in central Pennsylvania. And I would bring my little tapes and I would drive out there. And that's what I would listen to, from that to radio at Hot 97 and Funkmaster Flex. Like, yeah, hip hop was my escape. It was my escape.
Wow. And you mentioned Penn State there. Now, the funny thing, you went to school at Penn State, like you said, you know, for a little while.
Yeah.
You transferred to Hampton, but you kind of didn't tell your mom about that, right?
Yeah, your research is great. No, my mother didn't know. You know, I remember when I was at Penn State and I went because I wanted to be a lawyer. So I thought, you know, I was basically, I had been talked into it. It was a part of an internship program. And they were like, so what do you like to do, Rocky? I was like, oh, I like to read. I like to write. And they were like, okay, well, what do you want to do? I was like, I don't know. And they were like, oh, read and write. You should be a lawyer. I was like, oh, yeah, that sounds great. You know, made my mom proud. You know, it's a good label and title to have. So I was like, yeah, sure, lawyer. And somehow I majored in economics. I was doing corporate law somehow. It was fine, you know, but I still had this thing for hip hop in my head. I wanted to be on the radio and play hip hop. I remember. And I even remember in high school someone saying, you know, because my voice, I always had a deep voice, and they were like, oh, you could do radio. And it had never dawned on me. I was like, really? I can actually do that? And I was like, yeah, you could do radio. So that stayed in my head. And then in college, I was at Penn State and I knew I wanted to transfer. I didn't want to be there. I knew I didn't want to be a lawyer anymore. And I knew my mother was not having, and at that time I was scared of my mom still. And so I remember I transferred and I just sort of, you know, like I was paying for it, right? I just transferred and I called her and I think she got the paperwork. She was like, wait a minute, you're transferring. How are you going to transfer and not let me know? And, you know, she was upset. But I would say that was the first time when I actually felt like an adult and I was making an adult decision. And it changed the entire trajectory of my life.
Sure. And then you get to Hampton, you're studying broadcasting, you get a college radio show.
Yeah.
What was that show like?
It was great. It was called The Underground Review, and I played underground hip hop, and I liked to play the B-sides. It was like a late night show. I think it was like 10 o'clock, 10 p.m. or midnight or something, because the station was only on until like maybe 1 a.m. And it was amazing. I, you know, to get the free music and the records, and we would just have a ball. And that was just such a good time for hip hop. You know, that was the 90s. You know, that was when Jay-Z first came out and Wu-Tang first came out. And it was a really just fun time. And Biggie, you know, it was just a really fun time in hip hop. And I almost got into radio back then. It was like a DJ duo on the main station, Wowie, in Virginia, called the Buddha Brothers.
Oh my God, these men are bananas on the radio. Y'all might catch them. Wow. DJ Law, my man Big B, 103 Jams, you know what I'm saying?
And they were creating like almost like a ladies' night type show at the time. You know, Hot 97 had Ladies' Night and Angie Martinez, and they wanted to do a similar show. And that didn't work out, but because I wanted to be back in New York. I remember I was ready to leave the South.
The interesting thing about that whole process of you getting on air and having a show is it's unlikely, if only because you had a pretty severe stutter as a kid. How'd you get past that?
Yeah, I used to stutter. And you know what? I still do sometimes when I'm not focused, when I don't know what I'm going to say, put it that way. And so I think for me, you know, I was just telling someone else that, you know, my mother helped me with that. I was a big reader growing up. But as an artist, sometimes we have a lot of things in our head. We want to do it all at the same time. And it was definitely the same thing with my thoughts, and I remember her going, slow down, take your time, go slow and think about what I have to say before I said it.
After you left college, you moved into journalism and were having what I would imagine was a pretty demanding work schedule at Vibe that we'll get to in a minute. You got another you know, college radio show in New York. How on earth did you find time to keep a college radio show going in the midst of this whole crazy career?
You know, but you know, when you're in radio, the microphone is addictive. You know this. It calls your name. it's a weird thing, but only if you're on the mic, you understand it, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was at Vibe and I was there a couple years and I started to get this Jones to be back on the radio. I remember that. And I started, you know, networking and working to put the energy out there. I remember saying, I got to get back on the radio. I didn't know how, but through networking, I, you know, met some folks and there was a DJ Mecca. She had a show at WHCR at City College.
I want to welcome Prince Paul to our studios.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm all right. And yourself?
I'm feeling great. I'm feeling great. Welcome.
Why, thank you. Yo, you know what? I just want to let everybody know.
What?
Just for you listening. See, I drove all the way from L.I. and all this snow during rush hour traffic
during
to be
hour.
On Mecca's show tonight.
Thank you.
And she was leaving. And they were looking for someone. And a friend of a friend introduced me to the program director there. And he tested me. I was like, okay, we'll test you. And I basically just did the same show I was doing in college. It was like a, you know, the Underground Review wasn't just underground hip hop and B-sides. It was also filled with social commentary. So I talk about what was going on in the world from a hip hop perspective. And I just brought that to the airwaves. And I ended up being there like 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you mentioned your time at Vibe was before that. And you started there as an intern in what year did you start there? Do you remember?
95.
Yeah. Wow. This was sort of the early days of the magazine. What was the magazine like at that point?
Those were the good old days. You know, it was amazing to work a Vibe. I mean, these are the days when, like, Kevin Powell, you know, was a staff writer.
Kevin Powell first came to national attention as a cast member of the first season of MTV's Real World. True story.
True story.
He's written for publications such as Esquire, Newsweek, The Washington Post, Essence, Rolling Stone, New York Amsterdam News, and Vibe, where he was a founding staff member and served as a senior writer. He's interviewed and profiled General Colin Powell and Tupac Shakur. He's also hosted and produced programs for HBO, BET, and hosted and wrote an award-winning documentary about LA after the riots for MTV. He's an outspoken activist, predominantly focused on violence, particularly against women and girls, as well as the changing experience of being black and male in America. Powell's also co-founded the grassroots community town hall series Hip Hop Speaks, with social entrepreneur, activist, and writer April Silver, which he describes as a series of forums and MC battles geared towards using hip-hop as a tool for social change.
Who else was there? Joan Morgan.
Joan Morgan is an American author and journalist. She was born in Jamaica and raised in the South Bronx. She began her journalistic career at The Village Voice. Morgan was an original staff writer for Vibe and also worked with Spin, Working Mother, More, Ms., Interview, Giant, and Essence. In 1991, she covered the Mike Tyson rape trial for The Voice. Her most famous work is her 1999 book, When Chicken Heads Come Home to Roost, about the complexities of feminism for women who have grown up with hip-hop.
Bones Malone.
Bones Malone began his writing career at Youth Communication in 1986, where he was a teen writer and reporter for a magazine written by and for New York City public high school students. Malone developed his hip-hop writing style in a monthly column called Street Talk, which ran from 1987 to 1989. He went on to work for Vibe Spin, and in 1995, he wrote the Notorious B.I.G. cover story for the July issue of The Source magazine titled The King of New York, which became the magazine's highest-selling issue. In the same month of that year, his feature article, Deep Space Nine, was published in Vibe magazine, being the first article to introduce all nine members of the Wu-Tang Clan.
These were, you know, those were the days, like Karen Good.
Karen R. Good has worked at People, 17, Honey, and Vibe, where she was the associate music editor and writer at large. She wrote the liner notes for Erykah Badu's 1998 live release of Baduism, traveled with Mary J. Blige as a documentarian on her first South Africa tour, and interviewed a Hennessy-soaked rapper alone in the back of a limo while his female pit bull watched. Karen's Vibe feature about hip-hop groupies, the show The After Party The Hotel, was included in the anthology And It Don't Stop, the best hip-hop journalism of the past 25 years or so, which was edited by our episode 127 guest Raquel Cepeda. Karen's music writing has appeared in New York, Rolling Stone, Interview, Essence, Ego Trip, Details, and The Village Voice.
You know, these are the days of, you know, Vibe Music Seminar.
The Vibe Music Seminar was an industry convention hosted by the magazine, which they started in 1995.
You know, I don't know if you remember that. It's really taking it back. It was was just a really fun time. It was just a really fun time in the music industry and for me and hip hop, you know, the white parties that Andre Harrell would throw.
Wow. You made it to some of the white parties.
Yes.
Nice.
Yes. It was exciting. It was fun. It was fun.
That's amazing. For a while, you were, you know, much like the character in your book, The Man Curse, you were the assistant to the editor-in-chief.
Right.
In the real-life version, it was Danielle Smith, obviously.
Yeah.
Danielle Smith was named editor-in-chief of Vibe magazine in 1997, after working as its music editor from 1994 to 1996. This was the magazine's definitive era, and by 99, the readership had grown from 500,000 to 750,000. She then left to go work for Time. She has since written novels and taught writing at the university level. She also took the reins back at Vibe from 2006 to 2009 before moving to Billboard magazine, where she worked for 3 years as the editor-in-chief.
What was it like working for her?
Danielle was amazing. Danielle is definitely one of my mentors. She was really just down to earth and open, but I learned a lot from watching her, whether she knew it or not. You know, a lot about journalism, a lot about just not settling. From everything that makes a great story to great writing. She was definitely about just working to get the best and be the best and have the best. And, you know, you're only as good as your last story, you know. I learned that from her, and that's definitely something that I've carried throughout my journalism career. And I feel proud to say that, you know, I've come behind greatness, great writers like that.
Yeah. And I just have to ask, out of my own personal curiosity, how involved was Q? Did you see him ever?
You know what? I did meet Quincy Jones once. I met him a couple times. Like, he would come to the office and he would visit. He was really down to earth. He was like the cool granddad. You know, he really was. He was like, yeah, you know, the cat daddy. Hey, grandpa, he was cool. And even at the Vibe Music Seminar, he would be there and backstage. And, you know, I'd say, I'm an intern. And he always liked to talk to us and laugh with us and ask us about ourselves and what we were doing and how we felt. So, yeah, I got to meet him a couple times. He was just always cool.
Nice. And you worked on two big projects there that I wanted to get in a little more depth about. And the first one was their famous A Great Day in Hip Hop photo shoot.
Yes.
So for people who don't know or don't remember what it was, can you explain what it was and talk about your role in it?
Yeah, I actually have it now in my home. I'm looking at it. It was this amazing shoot that we did where we brought together a lot of the old school hip hop artists, a lot of them from the West Coast. And we went down to, I believe we were on the campus of Morehouse College. And what's funny is I did it with Minya O, Miss Info, who you might know. She was like my co-producer on it. It was like, I feel like I want to go get the picture now. It's right around here. I see it, but it's over there in the kitchen. But it's like Kumo D. It was Just Ice. It was Moni Love. It was D Barnes, Chuck D, KRS-One. It was so many greats from that time. And I remember just, you know, Def Jeff. Like, I remember being down there and they were just sort of in a circle and they were just, you know, just politic and just building, you know, on it was very conscious, you know, just talking about the world and what we need to do to change and what's going on and what the issues and these really intellectual debates. Like, it was a great time.
Wow. And, you know, so that was an update of the famous Great Day in Harlem photo,
right,
of all the jazz legends.
A Great Day in Harlem, or Harlem 1958, is a 1958 black and white group portrait of 57 notable jazz musicians photographed in front of a brownstone in Harlem, New York City. The photo has remained an important object in the study of the history of jazz. Art Kane, a freelance photographer working for Esquire magazine, took the picture around 10 a.m. on August 12th in the summer of 1958. The musicians had gathered at 17 East 126th Street between 5th and Madison Avenues. Esquire published the photo in its January 1959 issue. Among the people featured were Count Basie, Art Blakey, Dizzy Gillespie, Coleman Hawkins, Gene Krupa, Marion McPartland, Charles Mingus, Thelonious Monk, Jerry Mulligan, Sonny Rollins, Maxine Sullivan, Mary Lou Williams, and Lester Young. Kane calls it the greatest picture of that era of musicians ever taken.
What was the logistics for something like that like, of getting, you know, that many people in the same place at the same time?
It was hard. It was hard. I remember. I don't know how we did it. It was hard and it was expensive. And I feel like we went over budget.
I would, I would imagine it's like if you pay for one person's travel, then the whole house of cards falls, right?
Yes. It was hard. It was expensive. We went over budget and it was massive, but it was amazing. Like I still feel good to have, you know, to have done it. You know, a lot of folks, you know, they felt like, oh, you're biting off XXL.
In their October 1998 issue, only 1 month after the Vibe photo shoot discussed here, XXL ran a photo called The Greatest Day in Hip-Hop History as an homage to a great day in Harlem. The shot featured a whopping 200 hip-hop artists and personalities spread out across a fold-out cover. XXL arranged the photo at the same location as the original jazz shoot, 17 East 126th Street. Artists included Kool Herc, Grandmaster Flash, Wu-Tang, Scarface, The Roots, Common, A Tribe Called Quest, and even Criss Cross and Onyx.
We wanted to do something that was more specified to a certain generation, and show old to the old school.
Yeah. And another project you did there was Cheo Choker's book, Unbelievable, about Biggie.
Yes.
You worked on that. What was your role in that?
That came after my days at Vibe. But, you know, Vibe family, we tend to stay connected, you know, which is interesting. And it's like a big family. Like, you know, it's like, oh, Vibe, oh, your family automatically. And so Rob Kenner, who was the editor on that, and of course he comes from Vibe, they had began a branch of Vibe Books, and they knew I'd done numerous stories. I'd done a cover story. Was it a cover? XXL had done a tribute to Biggie, and I'd done the feature on Valletta Wallace. And, you know, went to her house, you know, and talked to her and Biggie's kids. And it was a really great piece. And so when that, after that came out and then Cheo had the book, they needed someone to do research and research and really reporting. And so just talking to different people that have been connected to Big, when he was alive and talking to him. So it was definitely the perfect fit because I'd already done my research and I'd already had those relationships.
Who were some of the people you talked to in that project?
Wayne Barrow.
Wayne Barrow was Biggie's manager.
I remember talking to a lot of label people. Mm-hmm. I remember that. Like a lot of promoters and A&Rs and, you know, they had me do those types of things.
Mm-hmm. Did you discover anything about Big, like either in doing the process of, you know, the interviews yourself or kind of looking and looking at other people working on the book that surprised you or that you didn't know? Well, first off, did you meet him while he was alive?
No. Can you believe that? I didn't get to meet Big. I didn't get to meet Pac. By talking to Miss Wallace, who I will always forever just have so much respect for her. I learned a lot about Big. And you learn a lot about someone from their parents. And I remember that, you know, one of the first quotes was she was saying, you know, she was sort of reciting one of his lyrics, like, you know, Big's got the lyric where he goes, no wonder why Christmas missed us. And she remember she's, you know, birthdays was the worst days. And I remember she was saying Christmas never missed us. And, you know, he's got another one. My mom pimps an act with minks on her back. She was like, I never had an act. She was just like, you know, Christopher has a big creativity, has a big imagination, but I don't know what he's talking about. It was funny. I remember that.
Nice. So, you know, you left Vibe to do, you know, as a staffer, to do some freelancing stuff. What made you make that jump?
I fell in love with writing. When I got the Vibe, I remember I didn't want to be a writer. You know, my internship wasn't even in the journalism department. I wasn't in editorial. I was in business. I was in marketing and promotions. I wanted to do events. That was my thing. Parties were fun. And when I got the job with Danielle, it was kind of on a whim, just me visiting from school. And they're like, Danielle, she just got hired. You should talk to her. And a casual conversation, literally with my sister, turned into an interview. It was weird. She ended up hiring me a few months later. And I'm sorry, what was your question? Your question was?
Oh, just about why you left to start freelancing.
Because I fell in love with writing. Mm-hmm. You know, so when I remember being at Vibe, I was there 2 years, and I remember they kept trying to give me stories. And I would be like, no, you sure you don't want to write? No. Are you sure? No. And a writer had flaked. There was a Chris Rock concert in Atlantic City. The writer at the last minute couldn't go. I had tickets because if Danielle couldn't go, I would get the tickets. That was one of the perks of the job. And I went down to Atlantic City. It was a great show. And I remember the writer flaked. And I'm like, oh my God, Rekia, can you please write this, please? And it was only like 100 words. And I remember I was like, oh, I don't want to write. I don't want to write. College had turned me off. I didn't want to write anymore. And I wrote it and I loved it. I remember and a lot of that had to do with the gentle nurturing of Danielle. She, you know, kept giving me all these accolades. This is great. This is great. And, you know, you start feeling yourself like, really? Wow, I'm a writer. Okay. And that's when it began. So after I left Vibe, you know, I just wanted to be free. And I began to write more there. And then I started seeking freelance projects outside of Vibe based off a lot of the contacts I'd made there. And next thing you know, I was writing for like Billboard, you know, at the time, Honey and everyone. You know, I was getting these assignments, you know, Double XL and The Source, and I loved it.
And so during that period when you were freelancing a lot, who were some of your favorite artists to write about? And maybe some of your, if you're willing to name names, some of your least favorite or you know, most difficult to work with?
Well, they would always pair me with the Thug MCs. Like, it never failed. They would go, they were like, all right, kid, we need you to... You know, at the time it was like Ja Rule or, you know, it was either the Thug MCs and definitely the, you know, at the time it would have been like some of like the up and comers, you know, remember Drag On. Remember Drag On?
Yeah, from Rough Riders, yeah.
Like, they would pair me with people like that. But I know some of my favorite. I remember interviewing Andre 3000. This was for a cover story, one on Andre and one on Big Boy. And I did Andre, and I remember going to his house in Atlanta. I remember his house was just so empty, but he had this music room and he had all these instruments in there. And this is right before he really went hard into his acting career. And I remember him at the time saying, you know, I'd like to focus on acting. You know, I want to do this and that. And, you know, you look at him today, you know, and what he's doing playing Jimi Hendrix.
The gig doesn't pay that much. No, we're broke, you know, but we're cool. Might as well hang out with us and be broke and cool.
I would say that's probably hands down. Even Miss Wallace going to her home, you know, when she's offering me her homemade chicken noodle soup, you know, just really having those types of intimate moments. And of course, there were other moments, you know, I don't want to name any names, but there were some scarier moments that I, you know, got to witness just being in the hip hop game.
We had Sasha Jenkins on a few weeks ago. And he talked about a very, you know, in retrospect, funny, but at the time, scary incident where he was interviewing some rappers and they actually brought out fake cocaine to try to front like they were kingpins and they were fooling around with guns and accidentally let off a shot in the house and all this kind of stuff. Did you ever see any, you know, what were some kind of crazy stuff you saw when interviewing?
Yeah, I've definitely seen crazy stuff. I've been in rooms with MCs who pulled out guns. MCs where if I named them, you'd be like, what? Like famous MCs pulling out guns, doing it in a casual sort of hee hee ha ha kind of way, you know, like quote unquote gangsters tend to do, smiling with the gun in their hand. I'm giggling, but at the time I wasn't giggling. You know, I've been in those rooms. I've been in studios where guns were pulled out. You know, I've seen people threatened. I have. Yeah, I've seen the side chicks. I've seen that. You know, and they try to act as if the MC would try to act like, oh, it's just my friend. But come on, a woman knows. Yeah, I've definitely seen some of the less flattering sides of what it means to be in hip hop in the music industry.
Yeah. And, you know, writing wise, you founded a magazine called The Av. For people who don't remember that magazine, what was that about?
Oh, man, The Av was amazing. The Av was, we called it a movement in print. And it was a hip hop magazine that focused on social issues as well. And so, you know, our whole thing was that, yes, in hip hop, we love our music, we love our clothes, but we also have an opinion on the world. So, you know, the thug on the corner, he has an opinion on what's going on in Iraq. At the time, it was Iraq or Afghanistan. You know, he has an opinion on the economy, you know, and money. He has an opinion on racism and inequality. in the world. So just because we listen to hip hop or we're young and in our 20s and we like, you know, to put some Mobb Deep on, you know, or some Jay-Z, doesn't mean that we are not talking about politics and what's going on with the world, or, you know, how we're going to raise our kids and what's next with the, what's wrong with the education system. That's what the AV was about.
Mm, yeah. And, you know, you moved back into radio, but first, you know, satellite radio, not as an on-air capacity much, as far as I know, but kind of, you know, behind the scenes working with Grandmaster Flash on his show. What was he like?
Yeah, that was pretty exciting. I, at Sirius, I did a multitude of things. I did do some on air. I did one of their R&B channels, and I also did one of their more pop formatted channels, playing groups like Hoobastank. Who would have thought? But I was like, Hooba, what? But it was fun, you know. But now Grandmaster Flash came apart because I was writing for radio. It was called a feature content producer. So writing and producing shows. And when Flash came in, he tended to be a bit scattered, as some artists are. So I was, you know, brought in to write for him some scripts to reel him in and to keep him focused. It was great. It was an honor to work with Flash. I mean, come on, this is Grandmaster Flash, guys. This is like one of the greatest DJs of all time. So
yeah, totally. And you made an interesting leap after that to Power 105. And
yeah.
So my question about that is, like, you know, you've been in college radio, you've been in satellite radio. How was commercial radio different from those experiences?
Commercial radio was different because my radio experience, let me just say, was different than the average radio personality. The average radio personality doesn't start in New York like I did. To get to New York, you have to do a lot of small markets first. You know, you go down to the country, you know, I think Wendy Williams was in the Caribbean at one point, you know. And that's sort of where you get your feet wet, and that's where you learn the radio game and learn the politics of it. For me, I went from college radio to Sirius Satellite to someone hearing me on Sirius and saying, oh, my gosh, I love your sound, to me making an air check, to getting it to that person who handed it to the program director of Power 105. And then they hired me because Moni Love went on maternity leave and I filled in for Moni Love. That's sort of how it happened. And so it was a beautiful experience, but the negative of it, or I don't want to say the negative, I say, but the disadvantage of it was that I didn't know what I was doing. You know, I didn't know how to play that game. You know, I got thrown in with the big dogs immediately. And what I did know how to do for the most part was get on the radio and talk. But I still, even at that point, by the time you get to New York, you should know, you should have your whole brand together, you know, your on-air persona. And I was still sort of working it out then. I was just sort of figuring it out, you know, and I had to make my mistakes along the way and come into myself in the number one market in the country.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of mistakes, I do have to ask about the reason you left Power 105.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you made some comments on air about interracial dating that got a lot of people upset.
Yes.
In March 2004, Mays was fired from Power 105 for what the station called, quote, inappropriate remarks. She said, quote, my confession this hour is that I'm a racist. I really am. I have a problem with white people. Not all white people, but a lot of white people. I can tell if they are being real with me or not. And then I hate when the black guy is walking down the street with a white girl. I hate both of them. Come on, there's a man shortage.
Can you walk us through, from your perspective, what you said that day and why you said it, and maybe how you feel about it now? Do you regret what you said at all, or do you wish you'd said it differently?
That's a good question. You know, and that, at that time in my life, I remember, this is how it went, and I don't even know if Ed Lover knows this. I remember, like, a few weeks prior, because I was had been there about a year, and I was trying to figure out my next step. I was like, I wanted to do bigger and better. I had been thinking about morning radio, and I remember I said, I was like, Ed, I got to talk to you. And I sat Ed Lover down and I said, how do you make it a radio? How do you, you know, what's the key? And I remember him saying, speak your mind. I remember him. He said,
faithful advice.
He said, I don't think he even remembers this, but I said, he said, speak your mind. Just, you know, a good radio personality tells their truth and they have an opinion. Right. So a few weeks later, it was a Usher Confessions week, and Usher dropped his album Confessions. Remember that?
Yeah.
And I was on like in the morning. It was like 10 a.m., 10 to 2 or something like that. And I had started doing these. I was like, oh, I have a confession. You know, I started doing confessions. Now, the mistake I made was setting it up at the end of the show. This is where I was green. So I didn't make an entire show out of it. I decided at about 1:30, the show's over at 2, that I'm going to start doing confessions. So I go, okay, we're taking confessions. I'll start. And my confession was, and I worded it wrong. You know, my confession was sometimes, you know, as a black woman, I have an issue when I see the black guy with the white woman. I get so mad. I don't like them. You know, I can't stand them. I hate it. And then I was like, what's your confession? And then my phones blew up.
I'll bet.
Yeah. There was this woman and she was like, I don't like what you said because I'm a white woman and I'm in a relationship with a black guy and you don't like me because I'm with him. And I'm like, that's not what I'm saying. You know, if I could have said it again, it was, there are some men of color who say they don't date black women and they intentionally look over. I know some of these men, I know men like this, and they don't date black women and they intentionally look over. And the reality of the situation is there are sisters out here, women of color out here, when, you know, they see an interracial relationship. But I think this can go for a lot of people. You know, they kind of look at the brother and brothers will say, you know, that they feel the sister looking at them. And so when I said that, and because I wasn't able to open it, I took one call that it was like, okay, thank you so much. I'll see you guys next week. It was raggedy. And I didn't realize what really happened. I had to go speak somewhere after that. And it was at a college. And I remember, you know, with like Rakia Mays, and there were some cheers and there were some people that it was, they were giving me the side eye and I couldn't pick up on what the energy was. I was like, what the hell? I didn't understand what was going on. And then weekend went by. This was on a Saturday. Weekend went by. Monday came. I happened to have a meeting with the program director. I'd been trying to, you know, talk to him about wanting to do more at the station. And he'd been trying to contact me. I went up to the radio station and he sat me down and he's like, oh, it's so good to meet with you. So I'm thinking we're going to start with our agenda for the meeting. he's like, Rakia, I got to let you go. I was like, what? He's like, what were these comments? You made some comments on the radio Saturday about interracial dating. And, you know, I'm getting some flack from the sales department. And, you know, one of our biggest advertisers, Pepsi, somebody was listening who was in an interracial relationship and her daughter was in the car and the daughter got upset and they complained and they didn't want to lose the Pepsi account or whoever the advertiser was. It was somebody huge and they let me go. Right. And if for anybody that's ever been let go from radio, the way they let you go is they walk you out right then and there. That's it. And so it was because I didn't know what to do. I remember, and I called, I can't remember who I called, but I remember them saying, what? That was your opinion? That's, you know, you had the right to say what you said. Are they censoring us on radio? Rakia, you need to use you're a journalist. You need to use your contacts and you need to call David Hinckley, you know, at the Daily News. You need to use your contacts. So I was like, oh, okay, cool. So I called David Hinckley and I'm like, this is what happened. And he's like, whoa, this is great. So it started with David Hinckley at the Daily News. And the whole conversation was about freedom of speech and what she said. And, you know, why did she get fired? Or maybe she got fired because she was, you know, they saw her as just a weekender, a peon. And, you know, it's all about the money and radio. And next thing you knew, it became this huge thing. And I would hear, you know, people talking about her, like Wendy Williams was talking about it. Howard Stern talked about it. The View talked about it. And I'm getting these emails like people are talking about it. It was like my 10 minutes of fame. And I was like on Channel 9. I was everywhere. I was on with Sean Hannity on Fox News. Like, it was crazy. And then a week later, Hot 97 hot. It was crazy. It was crazy.
Less than a week after being fired from Power 105, Rakia was brought on to Hot 97 to host a show during the same Sunday afternoon time slot she had just left.
So first off, what was Sean Hannity like?
Off mic, he's cool. On the air, he's an ass, you know, like, but that's his persona. You know, that's his persona. He's got his right-wing views and right-wing Christian conservative views, and he uses them. But off the mic, he's a cool guy. I'd have a drink with him. I just don't agree with his outlook and perspective on things,
sure.
Many things.
And moving to Hot 97, you know, there were definitely people at the time who said, oh, Hot's only hiring her to, you know, because yes. She's controversial. You know, it's not because of her, you know, abilities as a morning personality. They're just doing it to stir up ratings because she's controversial at the moment.
Hot 97's press release announcing Rakia's hiring actually touted her as controversial and noted that she was the first host hired by Hot directly from its rival station, Power 105.
How did you deal with people kind of buzzing like that about you when you moved over there?
It wasn't the first time. You know, my radio, when I began radio, like when I got on Power 105 and I was filling in for Moni Love, I remember that there were whispers like, oh, well, she's not permanent. She's just filling for Moni. I remember that. And I ended up being there for a year. You know, when I got to Hot, it was, oh, you know, why are they doing this? And I ended up being at Hot 97 for 5 years before I went over to Kiss FM across the hallway, you know? So, I think I've always, for a large part of my career, been an underdog where people have doubted, you know, what I've done. Even when I started acting, you know, I toured the country and was off Broadway for 5 years. That seems to be my magical number. But I've definitely continually had to prove myself and prove what I'm about and prove what I'm doing. And I guess it makes the win and the success that comes after all the better.
And you were at Hot 97 in the early aughts, right? When did you start there?
I was at Hot until maybe 2008. So maybe that's 2003. Tracy Clowerty was my program director.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. That tells you, it definitely takes you back a bit.
Yeah. And, you know, during the time you spent there, like, what was the culture of the station like? I know it has had a reputation for being a pretty wild place.
Hot 97. I mean, the reputation is wild, but I love Hot. That's still family to me, and it always will be family. You know, it's the entire MS Communications from Hot 90. It was Hot 97 and it was Kiss. And now it's Hot 97 and it's WBLS. And, you know, I think with the stereotype of hip hop, there's quote unquote drama. You know, I think sometimes people like to build that narrative, you know, but my experience with Hot was always, you know, and still is great. And that will always be family for me. You know, I've had the experience of working with Tracy Clowerty.
Tracy Clowerty has been working in radio and television since 1988. From 1988 to 2006, she worked her way up from the promotions department to the VP of programming for the New York radio stations Hot 97, Kiss FM, and WQCD. During her tenure as program director, Hot 97 was number one for 43 consecutive ratings periods, spanning more than 10 years. She has worked with Funkmaster Flex, Angie Martinez, Wendy Williams, and Isaac Hayes. Since 2011, she has been working at BET as VP of Talent for Music Programming, which includes shows such as 106th and Park.
You know, people have their outlooks on her, but to me, she was just a powerful woman in the business who was doing it. And some people really couldn't handle it. And when Tracy hired me, she sat me down and she said, you know, people think I'm doing this for controversy. And she was like, you know, I don't agree with them firing you. And she said, because I believe in freedom of speech and you had the right to say that, whether I agree with it or not. She was like, I don't agree with what you said. I'm a white woman who dates black men. You know, she said, but you had a right to say that. You had a right to say what I know a lot of black women feel. And she's like, that's why I'm hiring you, because that was BS, you know? I remember that. And she's always been a supporter of me throughout the years, even through everything she's done, and she's at BET. So that Hot 97 was like, and still is, it's like really like a really like supportive and team and loyalty, and you know, it's definitely like a tight knit family.
Cool. And you know, were you around for any of some of the more notorious incidents that happened, you know, outside the station, some of the shootings and things like that?
In the 2000s, there were a number of shootings outside Hot 97's offices involving artists and their entourages. In 2001, there was an incident with Lil' Kim and Capone of Capone and Noriega, the aftermath of which found Kim serving a year and a day in jail for lying to a grand jury. In 2005, there was an incident between The Game and 50 Cent. And on the somewhat less serious side, the rapper Gravy got shot in the left buttock after leaving the station in 2006, an incident that was presented in fictionalized form on The Sopranos.
No, thank God. I wasn't there at all. No.
Yeah. You know, when you left Hot, you moved to Kiss FM.
Yeah.
And you moved to morning radio. And so the thing I've always wondered about people who work in mornings is, like, how does it change your life? Not even, you know, being, you know, someone's drive time thing, but, like, starting work that early, you know, getting up that early, working that early, you know, working that early in the day. How does that affect your life? How does that affect your interactions with essentially the rest of the world who's on a very different schedule?
Yeah, it definitely affects you. I mean, morning radio is a grind. Morning radio is getting up at 3-4 in the morning and getting to work before 6 so that you can prep. And so if you're getting up at 4, then, you know, really you're going to bed like 10, 11, you know, but then a part of being a radio personality is you have to be out and about, you have to go out. So morning radio, you're always tired. You're always tired. So there's this thing where they talk about the morning show nap. So, you know, you do your show, you're off by 10, you have to have a meeting, you're out of the station by noon. And then you got to, there might be some more other things that you have to do. And hopefully you can get that power, that 30-minute power nap in, because then you have the other part of your day, if you're doing other things, which hopefully you are, you know, and have other irons in the fire. So, yeah, it's tiring and it's grueling and you are always tired. That's morning radio. You're always looking for topics to talk about. Everything is a topic. Everything in life, like, it never turns off.
Wow. So it's not just a conversation with your friend. It's constantly in your head, like, can I talk about this tomorrow morning?
Yep. And is it going to resonate? And then you have to deal with behind the scenes and the politics of it all, which are ratings, because it is about ratings. It is about money. And morning radio is the drive that brings in the most money. You know, you got morning drive and afternoon drive. So that's when people are going to work. That's when your advertisers are listening. You know, that's when people are in their cars and in traffic. So it's a lot of pressure. It's intense. Morning radio is intense.
Yeah. And one other thing you did at Hot 97 was you covered a lot of red carpets for movies and stuff like that.
I did.
Hey, this is Rakia on the red carpet of The Great Debaters. It's the movie about the debate team from East Texas, starring Denzel Washington, produced by Oprah Winfrey and directed by Denzel. Now, we're going to talk to some of the stars in the movie. Denzel, hopefully. Maybe Oprah. Maybe not. And some of the other stars.
How was jumping into that? Had you ever done something like that before? Did you know what you were doing? Like, what was, you know, transitioning into that like?
It was easier for me because my background is in journalism. It wasn't journalism. So for me, you know, I'd done things off and on. I think the first time I'd done camera work, I think Atlantic Records had hired me. There was a party Atlantic Records did, and they had a camera crew there. And they were like, Rakia, can you give us your opinion? I just was on camera doing what I do. And they were like, oh, that's good. And then I remember they had hired me to interview, to do some sort of promotional things and interview artists. And I guess that's the first time when I realized it just sort of came naturally to me. That's always come naturally to me, being on camera. And so, well, Hot 97, it was just a natural transition. And I still do it from sometimes to this day. I do it for WBLS, just on air, on camera interviews for the digital, and being on red carpets or one-on-ones and interviewing folks, you know? Yeah. It's fun.
What's the secret to getting the big stars to talk to you on a red carpet? Do you push people out of the way, you know, elbow people? How does it work?
Mm-mm. No, I don't do that. I just smile. and usually it helps that you have something that their publicists know. They know Hot 97. You know, they know WBLS, you know, so it's, if you have a relationship with the publicist, and you can talk to the publicist beforehand or get their eye, you know, when they're coming down, they're looking to see who's who and who's standing where. And you say, you know, I'd like to talk to, you know, Kevin Bacon, you know, and they'll usually bring them to you if you're polite and professional and they actually recognize and know who you are.
And, you know, when you're interviewing movie stars, I know you've done celebrity profiles for Ebony also, of, you know, Jada Pinkett Smith and all these kind of people. when you're dealing with someone who's, you know, not just rap famous, but like movie star famous, you know, famous the world over, has been interviewed so many times over so many years, how do you find something new and interesting to talk about?
Research, you know, literally working to find as many stories about them. And finding what she hasn't said, what she hasn't been asked, going through there now, it's a new age of social media. So going on their Facebook page, going on their Twitter page and their Twitter feed and seeing what they're talking about, seeing what they're passionate about. You know, I always like to ask, my favorite thing for a celebrity to say when I interview them is, oh, wow, I've never been asked that before. That's like my goal. Like,
yeah, I identify with that goal. That's what we try to do here also. So
right,
definitely.
Right. Yeah,
definitely. Speaking of celebrity interviews, I do have to ask, I saw a kind of awkward, at least, you know, from the viewer's perspective, interview you did with Terrence Howard around the time of The Best Man 2.
What about you, Terrence?
What?
The difficulties. What was different for you this
time? Nothing difficult for Terrence. Not at all. A diamond is just a piece of coal that did well under pressure. You know, that's what Quentin does. That's what Terrence does.
Funny.
Yeah, what on earth was that like for you?
Well, it's funny because Terrence Howard, he's a little intense. And so it's hard to tell if he's being sarcastic or if he's being real. Mm-hmm. So for me, it may have come off awkward. I didn't think it was awkward. I thought that, you know, he was like speaking in a, you know, with a third person about, you know, well, Terrence does this and Terrence does that. Terrence doesn't get nervous. But what I realized was that he was joking, you know, and so especially from my research, he's sort of tends to be the practical joker on set, you know, so working to keep a serious face. So if you don't know that about him, it comes off awkward, but working to keep a serious face and just, you know, you're waiting for the joke to drop. And that's what I got or felt from that particular interview. You know, he's being a jokester.
Yeah.
You know, but I think also testing the journalist, testing and seeing, you know, if this journalist actually has the confidence to ask the questions.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. And so I do want to ask about your first novel, The Man Curse, that is, you know, just coming out, should be out by the time our audience hears this. So I saw a video interview with you from probably 6 years ago where you said, you know, the book is coming soon, The Man Curse, it's almost here.
I'm a longtime freelance writer, currently working on a novel in stores soon, What, The Man Curse. And
years ago?
Yeah.
Wow.
What took a while about this book to finish it?
6 years ago. That's interesting. Could you send me that link, Sean, please?
Sure, of course.
I'd like to look at that.
Of course.
Yeah, it took me 10 years to write this book. This book, and you know, life gets in the way. And so, you know, as artists, we tend to have our hands in a lot of different things. You know, it's the business, it's the industry, you know, you call it irons in the fire. And so it was very difficult for me to finish this because I remember, you know, I was working in radio and that's, you know, and I was tired all the time. And then, you know, I still have to eat and I still have to write. I still have to work. And a big part of writing is finding time to write. That is the most difficult thing about writing, finding the time and the focus to actually sit down and do it. So that's definitely why it took me so long. And I, you know, and outside of work, you know, at the time I was married, you know, I was married for 5 years, you know, I went through a divorce. And so, you know, when you're going through emotional things, I know for me, I'm an emotional writer, you know, you tend to be blocked a bit, you know? It was difficult for me to write then. So I was working on it off and on, and I didn't really sit and focus and write and finish The Man Curse until I moved to LA. And when I moved to LA in 2011, I was there for 2 years and I was able, I was just away from a lot of the distractions and the emotional things, a lot of the emotional things that gone on at the same time in my life, losing my job, going through a divorce, my grandmother passed. And so being in LA gave me the space, to just, and the clarity to finally finish it.
And so what is the book about?
The Man Curse, I call it self-help fiction. But it explores the phenomenon of generational curses, which are mentioned in the Bible, and family cycles. that run throughout some families. It's told through the story of Mina Butler. Mina Butler, she's a young professional woman who is working to break the man curse and become the first woman in her family to ever marry. So, you know, it asks the question, is she cursed or is it all in her head?
Interesting. And, you know, it's you have a very interesting book deal for it. I heard you, you know, at a recent reading you did, you encouraged the audience, everyone, to buy it digitally. You said, oh, yes. All you need is $2, you know, take out your phone right now while I'm talking to you and download it.
Yes.
So how many of you guys have smartphones or tablets? Good. How many of you guys have $2? Good. So after this, what you're going to do is you're going to go to themancurse.com because my book is available for digital download.
Why?
Yes, it's exciting. My deal with Simon & Schuster, which is my dream publisher, I'm so thankful to be with them, is a digital deal. And I got that deal based off of my social media movement. Anybody that knows me on social media, I post a lot. unless it's my birthday. It was my birthday, so I didn't post that day yesterday. But I'm sorry, this is pre-recorded. Oh, but anyway.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Woo-hoo, thank you. So, I went off the grid yesterday. It was great. But I have a lot to say. And that is how I communicate and talk to the people, you know, and talk to the audience. And so they realize that. They saw I have like over 20,000 followers, and then my Twitter gets like 500,000 hits a day, which is strange. I'm like, what are they looking at? What are they reading? So that's why I got my deal. And when I got it, I remember my agent, you know, and I'm from the old school, and I was like, I kind of want to hold the book in my hand. And my agent was like, well, you know that digital is doing like 60 to 70% of their sales right now. And I was like, are you serious? And she's like, yeah. And she's like, you know, and I was like, well, she's like, I think you should do this. I think you should take this deal. And with what you do, you know, at the time I was a content producer working in digital media when I came back from LA. And she's like, you understand the medium, you know how to do this. You have moved me, you have followed, you have fans. I definitely think you'll do well with it. And so I was up for the challenge. I love my deal. You know, I was able to get all my rights. I'm making more money per book than an author would make with a physical book deal. Mm-hmm. So we have film interest, you know. It's pretty amazing. So it gives me the opportunity to do some really unique creative things to sell this book. So I'm excited.
And one of those things is you were, I don't know if you still are as we're speaking, but we're on a tour of doing events at Stores for the Limited.
Yes. It's a book reading tour and style session tour where I'm going into stores where I'm conducting book readings and Q&As with an excerpt from the novel where I actually mention The Limited, which is interesting because my book takes place in the 90s. And for a lot of women in the 90s, The Limited was like the hot spot. We all had our Limited credit card. And so my character shops at The Limited because she has a limited budget. she's working in the industry. She's trying to keep up with the folks and she can only afford The Limited. And so, and then they're conducting these sort of style sessions based off of my character, Mina Butler, and what she would wear as a professional woman. So I'm thankful for it. I'm thankful, you know, they've, you know, being a part of their New Look of Leadership campaign. And that began this fall where they picked women, about 60 women who they feel are leaders and non-traditionally and empowering, working to work and empower women in their own lives, which is one of my purposes I feel in my life. So to be a part of that campaign, to walk in the Limited and see myself on the walls, you know, store windows, it's just really an amazing experience. And I feel thankful to have the opportunity with a brand that I've actually shopped at and still shop at to this day.
Nice. And one thing about the book I know, or at least, you know, its categorization that has bothered you is, you know, either people or Amazon algorithms or something has been kind of putting it often in the urban fiction category.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk mm-hmm. about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's something that it's a debate that I'm realizing with publishing. It's actually a shared outlook that I have with my perspective, my imprint. I'm signed through Simon & Schuster, Gallery, Pocketbooks, Karen Hunter Publishing. Karen Hunter, as you know, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. an author, radio personality herself. And, you know, she's African American, she's of color. And I remember her, she agrees with me on, you know, what makes a book a black book? Is it black urban because the protagonist is black in urban? Because the author is black? Is that what makes it urban? You know, The Man Curse is not Terry Woods. You know, Rakia Mays is not Terry Woods. What she writes is completely different. You know, The Man Curse is not a Donald Goins book, you know? And so when we're put in all into that, there are different audiences for different readers and writers. And so when they sort of put us all in the same, it's, you know, we're not all the same. You know, we read different things, and The Man Curse is about love and self-love and relationships. And that's not a black thing. That's not a black woman thing. That's a people thing. We all want love. We've all made mistakes in love. We've all looked at ourselves and sometimes blamed ourselves at some point and wondered if there was something wrong with us because of our love lives.
Yeah. And, you know, finally, you have a very different kind of tour planned.
Yes.
What can you tell us about the Leading You to Love tour that you have planned to support the book?
Yeah, we are planning the Leading You to Love tour, actually seeking sponsorship on that now. I'm excited because it's a 13-city tour, 12 to 13 cities that takes us around the country and it unites with local radio personalities and tastemakers for book readings and intimate conversations about love with women where, you know, in non-traditional venues. And we're talking about how we sometimes block ourselves from the love that we want in our lives. And I definitely think it's a conversation that women can have in a room, you know, about these types of things, you know, the narrative that you can't have it all. You know, I don't believe that. I believe you can have it all, you know, but I also believe in the power of words. And sometimes if you say you can't, well, then you won't, you know, you manifest your reality through what you think and what you believe about yourself. So in each of these cities, we'll have these conversations. And then I'll also go to a local domestic violence shelter and conduct readings there, because one of the cycles that unfortunately does run in families that I cover in The Man Curse is domestic violence.
Oh, well, that sounds like a great and very important tour. I look forward to hearing more about it as it shapes up.
Thanks, Sean.
Thanks so much, Rakia. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for the interview.
Rakia's had such a wildly varied and fascinating career that I hardly knew where to start when talking to her. From college radio, to journalism, to the heights of commercial radio and beyond, she was always right there in the middle of it all, and I'm glad that I, and you, got to hear all about it. In addition, it was great to talk about this newest phase of her life as a novelist, and the ways in which it was connected to, and differed from, the previous aspects of her career. If you're interested in reading The Man Curse for yourself, you can find it at themancurse.com. Join us next week when we talk to Torre about his brand new album entitled. As I mentioned at the top, make sure you subscribe to The Cipher on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, give us a rating or a review. If you want to take an extra step to support the show, you can make a donation at patreon.com/thecipher show. Even a couple bucks a month will go a long way. You can find us everywhere on social media at The Cipher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. More information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, can be found at thecyphershow.com. While you're there, don't forget to sign up for our monthly newsletter. The Cipher is created and written by Sean Sataro.
Off mic, he's cool. On the air, he's an ass.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Who but what?
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Yeah, I got to meet him a couple times. He was just always cool.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
We're not all the same.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Scott Limbacher.
Yeah, I used to stutter. And you know what? I still do sometimes.
We'll see you next time around on The Cipher.
He's so funny, Sean. How's that? Is that like weird?